Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The first Clean Air Act was passed in this country back in 1963. It's been amended half a dozen times since then. But Washington took until today to decide the EPA can regulate what comes out of a car's tailpipe. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Marketplace is also supported by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. Today's April 2nd. And it's official. Carbon dioxide is a pollutant. The Supreme Court says so. The Bush administration had been arguing the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't have the authority to regulate greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide, when it comes out of automobile engines. But five members of the High Court read the Clean Air Act differently. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the EPA case was just one of two environmentally friendly rulings the justices handed down today.
Justice may be blind, but the Supreme Court is seeing green. Environmentalists say this decision was a long time coming.
I think this is one of the most important environmental decisions of the past quarter century.
Norman Dean is executive director of Friends of the Earth, one of the original plaintiffs in the suit.
Back in 1999, we petitioned EPA to issue a rule regulating greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles.
For years, the Bush administration has argued the EPA didn't have the right to limit auto emissions of carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. In today's 5-4 decision, the High Court disagreed. Justice Stevens wrote the Bush administration's claims were, quote, arbitrary, capricious, or otherwise not in accordance with the law. But will the EPA regulate greenhouse gases? Scott Siegel, a lobbyist for the electric utilities and petroleum refiners, notes today's decision stops short of ordering the EPA to do so.
The case does not mandate that the Environmental Protection Agency regulate carbon dioxide. What it says is that the agency did not do a very good job of explaining itself.
Still, both sides agree this decision increases pressure on the Bush administration to act. Score one for the Greens. In another potential victory for environmentalists, the High Court also sided with federal regulators trying to force Duke Energy to clean up old, coal-burning power plants. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Just like that, the country has a new media tycoon. Sam Zell made his billions in real estate. As of today, he's the new owner of the Tribune Company. It's an empire that includes 11 daily newspapers, including the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, as well as the Chicago Cubs, 23 television stations, and 20,000 employees. The deal is valued at about $8 billion, though Zell's only going to put up about $315 million from his own pocket. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports it's the deal's financing that's making those 20,000 employees a little uptight.
The new company will be private instead of public, and employees will become part owners under an employee stock ownership plan known as an ESOP. If the company thrives, workers will share in the profits, but if the company goes bust, workers could be left in what one Tribune employee describes as Enron territory. Michael Keeling, president of the ESOP Association, points to some positive statistics.
ESOPs are 15% more likely than their competitors to survive over a decade. State of Washington study, a state of Ohio study, they were more likely to pay higher current wages than non-ESOP companies.
Despite the potential upside, Tribune employees are nervous, in part because the company will take on a lot of debt. Thomas Mulligan is a financial reporter for the Tribune-owned Los Angeles Times.
I think people are attracted by the idea of becoming larger owners in their own company and in that way determining its fate, but also they realize that the risk of insolvency rises with a great deal of new debt.
Starting next year, employee retirement contributions will be paid in part with company stock. But even with the risks, Mulligan says the newspapers must get entrepreneurial if they are to survive.
Sometimes that can be better done as a private enterprise than as a public one, where you're sometimes subject to short-term thinking on the part of Wall Street.
So the Tribune will trade Wall Street pressures for an increased debt. Meanwhile, employees cross their fingers and hope that debt doesn't translate into cutbacks and layoffs. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
One more thing to add about the Tribune sale. CEO Dennis Fitzsimons said today he'd really love for the Cubs to win it all this year. The team's going to be sold off at the end of the season to pay down Tribune's debt. Of course, the Cubbies got shellacked today by the Indians, 12-5. Ads for Celebrex are back after a two-year absence. Pfizer makes the arthritis drug. It works in the same way as Vioxx does. You might remember Merck pulled it off the market in 2004. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH. Pfizer is taking great care bringing Celebrex back to the small screen.
Ads for the super aspirin Celebrex used to celebrate the things the drug lets you do pain-free. But not anymore. Tonight's ad runs 2.5 minutes, and much of it's devoted to the potential dangers of Celebrex and other anti-inflammatory drugs like it called NSAIDs.
Any prescription NSAID, including Celebrex, may increase the chance of heart attack or stroke, which can lead to death.
It's unprecedented in that the risks are talked about right up front.
Pfizer's Steve Romano says there'd been so much bad publicity about NSAIDs after Vioxx was withdrawn, they needed a marketing makeover.
You'll see when you see the ad that it is a very upfront, thorough discussion of those potential risks.
John Schommer of the University of Minnesota calls this a clever strategy that could build credibility. But it may not work because of all the bad publicity surrounding these drugs.
A lot of people will still say, I see through what you're trying to do. I still don't believe it. I'm not persuaded.
Steve Schondelmeyer, who teaches pharmaceutical economics at the University of Minnesota, thinks people might underestimate the risk because Pfizer compares Celebrex with drugs you can buy over the counter, like ibuprofen. And there's another unfavorable comparison.
Cost is not talked about here, price of the drug and relative price. And this drug is substantially more expensive than the other drugs they're comparing to in terms of safety.
Celebrex costs around $2 a pill for the lowest dosage, compared with a few cents for generic ibuprofen. Andrew Casper of the pharmaceutical newsletter The Pink Sheet says the ad could help Pfizer claw back more of the $3.3 billion market Celebrex had in 2004. The Vioxx scandal slashed that in half.
Last year, Celebrex grew 18%, which means that Pfizer's message is getting through to consumers and to prescribers as well.
Casper says the ads are creating so much buzz, he sees a big boost to Celebrex. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Investors worked their way through some down arrows today to finish higher at the bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Apple CEO Steve Jobs was his usual understated self at a press conference this morning.
This is a landmark event and is the beginning of a major shift that will take place this year, resulting in consumers being able to purchase music from any digital music store and play it on any digital music player.
Jobs was in London for an announcement by EMI. The record label is going to sell its songs online without any copy protection, through Apple's iTunes, of course, which explains why Jobs was there. To be fair, though, Jobs has been pretty vocal in calling for copy protection technologies to be lifted. We still don't know whether the rest of the recording industry is going to follow EMI's lead, but commentator Celia Hirschman says there is a way to make the whole thing a win-win for everybody.
According to Big Champagne, the internet measurement company, American consumers freely trade over 1 billion music tracks each month. Still, the record industry says they're winning the war on illegal downloading. Someone should tell them you can't solve a problem unless you first admit there is one. And the problem is that consumers just want to hear their favorite music in an easy-to-download, user-friendly, inexpensive way. That's why illegal downloading won't go away. That's why peer-to-peer networks have grown so quickly. Folks don't want to get subpoenas. They just want to hear good music. Want to know how the record business could save itself, pay artists, and eliminate piracy easily? Simple. Make the internet service providers the point at which a download is counted. Whether you buy from iTunes or steal from BitTorrent, an internet service provider, or ISP, brought the music to you. The ISPs know what was downloaded and will never have to reveal it, but make the ISPs pay into a royalty pool managed by an independent third party. The consumers would pay a minimal monthly amount as part of their internet bill based on the amount of downloading they do. The more files they download, the more their bill would be, though it would still be pennies on the dollar. The royalty pool would be divvied up and distributed to the artists, publishers, labels, and songwriters based on how much their songs are downloaded. Everyone would get paid fairly for their work. The cost of maintaining the royalty pool is tiny since the internet offers accurate measurement. Changing the system of downloading music would shut down piracy and illegal peer-to-peer downloading. Think about it. The industry would recover from their devastating financial losses. Bands would get paid for their work, and we could all go back to enjoying the music, which is really the point, isn't it?
CLA Hirschman's a music commentator for KCRW here in Los Angeles. Your thoughts are always welcome. Just go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. You've got your choice tonight when you settle back on the couch for a little quality television time. You could watch the NCAA basketball finals, Ohio State and Florida. You could catch some of Dancing with the Stars, or you could tune into Fox. 24 is on. A show called Prison Break's on right before that. It gets respectable ratings, nothing spectacular. But over in China, it is the hottest show bar none. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now on the power of word-of-mouth marketing in the world's biggest consumer market.
Officially, the TV show Prison Break doesn't exist in China. Shows about crime or violence are banned.
Hey, buddy, give me his gun.
But in much of China, there's the law, and then there's reality.
You're not shooting anybody, neither are you. Give yourself up and your kid can walk.
Each week, tens of millions of young Chinese viewers keep up with The Great Escape by downloading from illegal websites. 26-year-old Ken logs on a mere 8 hours after an episode airs in the States.
And right there, it pops out. I mean, Prison Break is like the most popular show these days, so it's always on the first line. So you can just click it, and the downloading process just starts automatically.
On Ken's favorite site, 50,000 people downloaded Prison Break last week. That's five times more than any other show, for instance, Desperate Housewives. So how did Prison Break become the program du jour? Some say the pace and the special effects make the domestic Chinese dramas seem dull. 25-year-old Celine catches Prison Break by buying bootleg DVDs. Seems they're on sale every other block.
It's very hot in the United States, and the hero of the show is very attractive.
When a show like this gets so popular, Sean Ryan suspects there's just one explanation: digital word of mouth.
You have to understand the power of the internet in China.
Ryan runs the market research firm CMR.
It's much more powerful than in the United States or any other country in the world. More people who are in the youth segment between the ages of, say, 18 and 28 are online than in any other country.
More than 130 million Chinese are online today, and the vast majority of them read blogs to get other people's opinions and buying preferences.
The numbers in China just demolish YouTube and numbers in the United States.
And that makes home video a huge market opportunity, an estimated $3 billion a year. Thing is, just about all of that goes to the pirates, who seem to operate with impunity in China. This street hawker offers DVDs for 75 cents. Prison Break is always prominently displayed. A traffic cop stands about 15 feet away, ignoring him. I ask the seller if he's ever been busted. He shrugs and says, yeah, once. They confiscated my DVDs. But a few days later, he just reloaded and was back in business. So what's Hollywood to do about all this? If you can't beat him,
part of the strategy is to actually compete with the pirates.
Ellen Eliasoff is with Warner Brothers China. The company has just started putting out low-cost, legitimate DVDs on the street for about $2 or $3 each. Warner is betting that people will pay a little bit more for reliability, because customers may not get that with the bootleg videos.
They may find that the packaging says it's one movie, but that what's actually on the DVD is something else. And sometimes there's strange dubbing in Yugoslavian or whatever it is, and they'll just say, well, I just wasted my money.
She says the legal DVD campaign is starting to work, but she won't cite any numbers.
Some pirate retail chains have been converting over to stocking the legitimate ones, and the sales volumes, particularly for the ones where we have our own Chinese language movies that we've developed, sales volumes are really going up nicely.
Still, Prison Break fanatic Ken isn't sure he'll pay a premium just because it's the real McCoy.
If they put the selling price 2 times or even higher than the pirate ones, I don't think it's going to work.
It's a tough environment, and the industry knows it'll take a decade or more for the Hollywood empire to strike back against the pirates. Still, in a place where 2.5 billion DVDs are sold every year, even a tiny share of that treasure chest is real money. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, Geeky Cowboys Unite.
I didn't think I could sell the Big Nerd Monastery, so we came up with the idea of the Big Nerd Ranch.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials padded up 27 points today, 0.2% to close at 12,382. The S&P 500 edged up 3 points, 0.25% to finish at 1424. The NASDAQ stood pretty much still, closing basically where it opened at 2422. U.S. bank stocks showed no enthusiasm after a Fed official signaled that interest rates might not drop even if the economy does weaken. Citigroup, the biggest U.S. bank, dropped 0.5%. But a clutch of takeovers kept the markets from slipping. As you heard earlier, Sam Zell's bid went through, sending Tribune shares up more than 2%. First Data agreed to a $29 billion takeover offer from private equity firm Kohlberg Kravis Roberts today. The credit and payment processor saw its stock shoot up 20%. AirTran upped its offer for Midwest Air. AirTran got no lift from the deal, but Midwest ramped up 7%. Bond prices were unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note closed at 4.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Detroit, automakers report sales figures for March. The biggest automakers get ranked on environmental performance. The Union of Concerned Scientists releases its biennial analysis. And Tennessee and Rutgers face off in the Women's NCAA Basketball National Championship. Game takes place in Cleveland. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. From American Public Media, I'm Kai Rizdal. Much of the news from Wall Street comes prefaced with a mention of one or the other of the big investment banks. But before there was a Goldman Sachs or a Morgan Stanley, there was a company named Lazard Frere. For decades, Lazard was the most prestigious firm on Wall Street. Its partners knew who to talk to get the deals done and how to profit without putting their own capital on the line. William Cohen spent 6 years working at Lazard. His book is called The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere and Company. Not so secret anymore, I guess. Mr. Cohen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
Lazard Frere was, maybe still is, one of the iconic names on Wall Street. Where does it fall sort of in the pantheon of the big, big investment banks that have been in history?
Well, I think it depends upon the time frame that you are talking about, because there was a time sort of after World War II, and before the 80s, when all of Wall Street firms were small private partnerships. So during that time frame, Lazard was as competitive and as strong, and in some ways even stronger in mergers and acquisitions than any other firm on the street.
They never really put
their own capital on the line. These guys basically gave advice and made a whole lot of money doing it.
Exactly right. I believe that people like Felix Rohatyn and Michel Davidve and André Meyer really created the business of giving M&A advice to corporations. What they got paid for, what most of Wall Street continues to get paid for, is essentially getting close to corporate CEOs, winning their trust, cozying up to them, becoming their trusted advisor. And when it comes time to, as CEOs are doing more and more in this particular cycle, decide to buy a company or merge with another company, they seek the advice of these trusted financial advisors.
There's a mystique, though, that comes with Lazard that Goldman or J.P. Morgan or Merrill Lynch or any of those guys, they just don't seem to have, really.
For a period of time, and a long period of time, Lazard was able to attract the best and the brightest minds inside its doors because it offered the chance to work with all the best minds on Wall Street. We used to say about Lazard that it would compete with intellectual rather than financial capital, and it really set it apart from other firms, and that's, I think, why the mystique was created.
What eventually happened to Lazard, and what's it doing now?
As the competition rose, other firms on Wall Street in the 90s and continuing to this day figured out a way to compete with Lazard. You know, come 2001, the firm was in crisis mode. I think Lazard is still able to compete effectively, and it's had, you know, a great run under Bruce Wasserstein as a public company. But I find it to be common now.
What's your opinion now, having spent years researching this book and talking to people on Wall Street? What's your opinion, sort of in a very macro sense, of investment banking and the function it serves in a capitalist society?
I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. On the one hand, where Wall Street takes risks with their own capital, underwrites stocks and bonds, and puts their money on the table and risks that money, they deserve to get well paid for that risk. The world of M&A advice is a risk-free world. No money is put up by the investment banks. And so what I'm still, you know, frankly, unable to reconcile after all these years is why investment bankers who provide M&A advice get paid so much. I just don't understand it. I don't understand why the fees are so high. And I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of corporate CEOs look at this advice as a quote-unquote insurance policy, something they can point to if things go bad. And I think there's also a cartel element. There's really, you know, maybe 10 or 15 firms globally that provide this advice on a first-class basis, and they're able to set the fees.
William Cohen's book about Lazard Frères is called The Last Tycoons. Mr. Cohen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
It wasn't so long ago a computer would fit only on your desk and not in your backpack, when phones had to be attached to walls and all they did was let you talk. Nowadays, you can carry as much computing power in your pocket as the biggest supercomputer had back in the 1970s. But to help program all those gizmos, software designers are taking a cue from a simpler past. Philip Grazer found a place where techies go to enjoy the silence.
We're in the middle of a 14,000-acre nature preserve in Middle Georgia, and inside a resort hotel, dappled by sunlight and surrounded by swaying pines, Aaron Hillegass teaches 17 tenderfoots about the complex beauty of software coding.
So we actually use a C function for this, and the C function is NS Run Alert Panel. You give it the title.
Welcome to the Big Nerd Ranch. Hillegass founded it 6 years ago so computer developers could focus on learning programming skills, far from outside distractions. Hillegass was the head trainer at Next and Apple. To programmers, he's kind of like Yoda, but taller. He says Big Nerd isn't so much a ranch as a kind of Zen hideaway.
Monks would retreat from the world so they could do their spiritual work in quiet and in a community. So I didn't think I could sell the Big Nerd monastery.
So we came up with the idea of the Big Nerd Ranch.
A couple of other companies offer similar training, but those are day-long seminars held in rented meeting rooms. Compared to that, the Big Nerd Ranch is like Club Med. From the moment developers arrive until they leave 6 days later, all nerd needs are attended to.
The idea in a monastery is that prayers happen at a certain point and meals happen at a certain time, and there are no surprises because surprises would be distracting from what you're there for. So we always make every day exactly the same, and everyone knows what's going to happen after the first day.
The ranch's logo is a 10-gallon hat with a pinwheel on top. But at the Big Nerd Ranch, you won't find horses, or any other ranch activities, really. There wouldn't be time. Nerds spend 12-hour days mastering computer application tools while munching cookies and downing unlimited Mountain Dews. At 8:30, 12:30, and 6:30, there's plenty of time to discuss computer applications some more over buffet meals. And every day, precisely at 2 o'clock, there's a nature walk. Standard topic of conversation, computer applications.
Your computer?
Yes.
Yes. Well, there's the telephone. NS speech recognizer.
It costs $3,500 for the week-long course, but most students' employers pick up the tab. We're talking big companies like Apple, Google, or General Dynamics. The payoff is programmers who can design bigger and better software. Well, better anyway. Ashley Hotgraver is working on a not-so-big program she calls Eggminder.
You put in how many eggs you eat per day, and then you put in how many eggs you have in your fridge, and it'll tell you, it'll advise when you need to buy eggs.
For students, of course, the real payoff is a chance to commune with their nerd brothers and sisters. Patrick Usser works for a California sound production company.
You know, I mean, you can go out and you can buy a book, but it's not the same thing as being around a bunch of people who share the same interest, and you can start talking to somebody about stupid things like something that interested me about the Spotlight API.
Spotlight API, by the way, is an application tool. Okay, so it's not exactly singing cowboy songs around the campfire. But for nerds, this kind of thing makes them feel at home on the range. In Pine Mountain, Georgia, I'm Philip Grazer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, the 1980s TV series Knight Rider, starring the talking robotic car Kit, not to mention David Hasselhoff, never was what you'd call high art. But for collectors of pop culture ephemera, it is a goldmine. A car dealer in Dublin, Ireland, is selling his vintage mint-condition Kit car that was used in the series, asking price about $150,000. It does have a couple of limitations, though. It can't talk or drive itself or go 300 miles an hour. For that matter, it's not even street legal because it's missing some smog equipment. Caveat emptor, I think, is the phrase you're looking for here. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 27 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ was basically flat. Marketplace's producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, our monthly series on individual life and the global economy continues. Tomorrow on Working, a profile of a foreign correspondent's best friend, The Fixer.
We do hang a lot of trust on Fixers. They watch your stuff, sleep in the shady hotel room next door, tell you which road is safe. If you can't trust them, who can you trust?
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.